Good morning. It's my pleasure to be here this morning. For those of you who are not familiar with who I am, my name is Frank Abagnale. Back in the 60s, a lot of newspapers gave me a lot of different names. Some newspapers for many years referred to me as the Great Imposter. The New York Times wrote a syndicated column about me for over 5 years. The New York Times referred to me as the Skyway Man. And not too long ago, the Wall Street Journal, summing up my career, said I certainly will probably go down in history as the world's greatest con man of all. I earned all of those reputations when I was 16 years old and ran away from home. At the age of 16, I successfully impersonated an airline pilot for Pan American Airlines for 2 years until I was about 18 years old. At the age of 18, I became the chief resident pediatrician of a Georgia hospital where I practiced medicine for over a year. At the age of 19, having never been to law school in my life, I took the state bar exams in Louisiana. I passed the state bar exams. I became a licensed lawyer, and by the time I was 19, I was the assistant attorney general of the state where I practiced law for about a year. At the age of 20, I was a college professor at Brigham Young University in Provo, Utah. I taught 2 full semesters there as a PhD. Mormons haven't quite got over that yet, but they're still working on it. And before I was old enough to drink, I was a millionaire twice, having written over $2.5 million worth of bad checks in over 26 foreign countries and all 50 states in the United States. A lot of people say, you know, I've seen you on Johnny Carson many times, I've read your book, but what I've always wondered is, how did a 16-year-old ever get away with these things, and why did a 16-year-old do it? Well, I can't say that I came from the slums and it was my way of breaking away. On the contrary, I came from an extremely wealthy family in New York, in Westchester County, right outside of New York City. I was brought up in a private Catholic school. I went to a men's finishing school in Europe. I was one of 4 children in the family, the middle child. And at 16, my parents, after some 22 years of marriage, decided to get a divorce. The divorce had quite an emotional effect on me, being the middle child and the age I was. And I finally decided to rebel and run away. During the mid-1960s, running away was a very popular thing to do. Unfortunately, a lot of people got caught up in the hippie scene and drugs. Instead, I ended up just simply packing very few belongings and leaving home. But unlike most runaways, I didn't return home for quite a while. It was about 7 years before my parents ever saw me again. Arriving in New York City, I started looking for a job. There were a lot of signs on the store, stock boy, delivery boy. I'd walk in and apply. How old are you? 16. How far did you go in high school? 10th grade. I'll hire you, $1.25 an hour. And I stocked shelves. But I soon realized I couldn't support myself on $1.25 an hour. I was 16, but I was 6 foot tall, and I've always had a little gray hair, and I always looked so much older. I decided that maybe if I lied about my age, they'd pay me a little more money. So I walked around looking for the same type of work, but when asked my age, this time I said I was 26. People believed me, paid me a little more money, but even with that, it was difficult to make ends meet. One of the few things I took with me when I left home was a checkbook. I had a checking account since I was about 14, had a couple of $100 in the account, so every so often I would write a check, $10, $15 in Manhattan, and cash it. It was my friends, my peers, who used to walk along the streets with me and say, you know, Abagnale, you're the only guy I know walks in the bank in the middle of Manhattan, you have no account there, they don't know you from Adam, and they cash your check. Oh, well, my checks are good. Yeah, but if I wasn't in there, they wouldn't cash my check. You, they don't bat an eye. Years later, reporters would say that that was my appearance, my dress, my mannerisms, my speech that allowed me to do that. Whatever it was, consequently, I was able to cash the checks, and when the $200 ran out, I kept writing the checks. Well, now with the police looking for me for the checks, and my parents probably putting a lot of political pressure on the police to find me as a runaway, I thought it was a good time to start thinking about leaving New York City. But I was quite apprehensive about going to Chicago or Miami. After all, would they cash a New York check on a New York driver's license as quickly as they did in Manhattan? I was walking up 42nd Street one afternoon about 5 o'clock, 16 years old, and I passed the front door of a famous hotel that used to be there, the Commodore Hotel. And just as I got to the front door, out stepped an Eastern Airline flight crew. I couldn't help but stop to let them pass by me on the sidewalk. They were boarding a van to take them to the airport. And as I watched the captain, the co-pilot, the flight engineer, and about 4 flight attendants board the van, I kind of stared at them for a moment. And as they drove off, I continued up the street and I thought to myself, what a perfect front. If I could pose as an airline pilot, then I could travel all over the world, and I probably could get just about anybody anywhere to cash a check for me. Well, I walked up to 42nd Street and Park, and I crossed over, and there used to be a Horn and Hardart's cafeteria on the corner, And I was eating a sandwich when I looked out the window, and there was the 65 floors of the Pan American World Airline building. I thought, what a perfect airline to use, Pan Am. They fly all over the world. So the next day, I placed a phone call to the executive headquarters of Pan Am. And when the switchboard answered, I really had absolutely no idea what I would say. But years later, the FBI would write that I was a difficult criminal to catch because I was a criminal of opportunity who didn't really premeditate his crimes. When the switchboard answered, I hesitated a moment and I said, "Hey, yes, ma'am, could you connect me to someone in your purchasing division?" "One moment, sir." And a clerk came on and I said, "Yes, maybe you can help me. My name is John Black. I'm a co-pilot with the company based out of San Francisco. You know, I've been with the company about 7 years. I've never had anything like this happen to me before." "What's the problem?" "Well, we flew a trip in here last night, 24-hour layover. We're continuing to London this evening. And I sent my uniform out through the hotel to have it dry cleaned. But now the hotel and the cleaner say they can't find it. And I have a flight in about 5 hours. "Well, don't you have a spare?" "Certainly, but not with me." "Well, hold on." And he came back and he said, "My supervisor said this has happened before. I'm afraid it's going to cost you the price of a brand new uniform." "Well, I understand that." "Well, just go down to the well-built uniform company on Fifth Avenue. They're our supplier. I'll call them and let them know you're on the way." Well, that's exactly what I wanted to know, so I went down to the well-built uniform company, and a little Jewish fellow, Mr. Rosen, fitted me out in the uniform. Now, standing there, 6 foot tall, the black uniform with the 3 gold stripes on the arm and the gray hair, I certainly looked old enough to be the pilot. And when he was all done, I said, "How much do I owe you?" He said, "Well, the uniform's $286. I said, "No problem, I'll write you a check." No, I can't take any checks." "Oh, no problem, I'll just pay cash." No, I can't take any cash. You have to fill out this computer card, put your employee number in these boxes, and we bill it back under uniform allowance. Comes out of your next Pan Am paycheck." "Oh, that's even better. Go ahead and do that." So I don't know who paid for the uniform, but out the door I went. Now, in New York, there are 2 major airports, LaGuardia and Kennedy. I went to LaGuardia because it was the closest to the city. I spent most of the day walking around LaGuardia with this uniform on, trying to figure out that now that I had the uniform, how do you get on these planes? Well, I got a little hungry, so I walked in the luncheonette in the terminal, and I sat down up at the counter on a stool, and moments later, in walked a TWA crew. Flight attendants sat in the booth, pilots set up on the counter on either side of me, and the captain right next to me. Now, airline people consider themselves one big family, so they don't hesitate a moment to talk to each other, and the captain kind of leaned over and he said, "Hey, young man, how's Pan Am doing?" "Oh, we're doing just fine, Captain, just fine." "Tell me, what's Pan Am doing out here at LaGuardia? You guys don't fly into LaGuardia. You only service Kennedy." Well, I picked up on that right away. I said, "Oh, I was just visiting some friends of mine. We had a short layover, and I came over to see him. As a matter of fact, I'm on my way back to Kennedy now. Ask for my check." He said, "Tell me, young man, what type of equipment are you on?" That completely threw me. Now, if the man had said to me, "What type of plane do you fly?" I would have said 707, DC-8. But airline people have a lot of jargon for things, and one of them is that they never call a plane a plane. It's called equipment. So that's what he was asking me, but when he asked it that way, I didn't know what to answer. What type of equipment was I on? I thought about it for a moment. The only equipment I knew I was on was a stool. And I thought for a moment, and I thought, well, they have the wings, and they always have the engine on the wing, and they always have a sticker on the engine who makes the engine. So I turned and said, "General Electric." All 3 pilots kind of just stopped eating. They looked at me, and I started to pay for the check. The captain said, "Oh, really? What do you fly? Washing machines?" And I knew I said the wrong thing. I knew that in order to do anything, you needed an airline ID card, a plastic laminated identification card. And when I finally realized that at the end of the day, I thought, well, this will never work. Where would I ever come up with a Pan Am ID card? So I went back to my hotel in Manhattan. I was sitting on the bed, and I noticed the big Manhattan Yellow Pages, and I opened them up under the word identification. Well, there are about 3 or 4 pages of companies who made convention badges, metal badges, ID badges. And I started to call around, and finally one company said, "Look, most of those airline IDs, they're made by Polaroid, the 3M company, DataCheck. You need to call one of them." And I finally got the 3M company on the phone, and they said, "Yes, we manufacture Pan Am's ID system. How come?" I said, "Well, I'm a purchasing officer for a large airline in Puerto Rico. We're getting ready to expand our routes, and I'm in New York just for today. I'd like to come by and look at a sample. We might be interested in purchasing the system." "Why, certainly. Come on by." So I put a suit on. I went down to the office, and the gentleman opened the catalog. And he said, "As a matter of fact, we do Eastern, Delta, United. Here's Pan Am right here." I said, "Yeah, we like this Pan Am format very much. You think I might get a sample to bring back to my board of directors?" "Certainly. I'll be right back." And he came back with a 5x7 glossy piece of paper with a picture of an ID card on it, someone else's picture in the picture, in red ink across the front, sample. I said, no, I'm afraid this won't do. You see, I'll need to bring them back an actual card so they can see the thickness and the size. By the way, what is all this equipment? Oh, is this a camera, laminator, cutter, reducer? We don't sell these cards. We sell this whole system. Oh, we'd have to buy everything. Certainly. Well, I tell you what, since we have to purchase all this, why don't you just use me and demonstrate how it works? Fine, have a seat right here. Take my picture and out the door I went. But going down the elevator, I was discouraged because it was a beautiful ID card, had my picture on it, everything I told them to type in. But up at the top, where Pan Am's name and their insignia would be, it was blank. And being a plastic card, you couldn't type on it, you couldn't write on it, you couldn't print on it. When I got to the lobby, I almost threw it away. Going down the street, discouraged, I was walking along, and out of the corner of my eye, I saw a hobby shop. And I strolled in. I said, excuse me, sir, you sell models of commercial airliners? Sure, over there on the wall. And I bought a Pan Am model for about $2.40. I threw the model away, but I took the decals out of the box. And the little Pan Am logo that would have went on the tail of this little model went beautiful, right up at the top of the card. And the word Pan Am and their special styling of graphics went right across the top of the card. Well, the ID card looked perfect. Pan Am would later write that they estimated that over those 2 years, I flew an estimated 3 million miles for free. They said that I was in over 86 countries. But as Pan Am has always said, not once did he ride on board one of our planes. Pan Am is correct. I never rode on Pan Am because I was afraid someone might say to me, you know, I'm based in San Francisco. How come we've never met before? Or, you know, your ID card, it's not exactly like my ID card. So I rode on everyone else. And it was pretty routine. I'd be out at New York and I'd look up on the board Eastern Flight 800 to Chicago. I'd have the uniform on, the ID card, and I'd walk downstairs to Eastern Operations. And I'd walk in and the operation clerk would look up, hey, Pan Am, what can we do for you? I was wondering if the jump seat's open on 800. I need the deadhead to Chicago. 800? Yeah, it's open. You need a pink slip? And they'd give me a pink slip pass, and I'd show my ID card, and I'd walk out, hand it to the flight attendant. She'd open the door to the cockpit, and I'd step in. And there you have a captain, co-pilot, flight engineer, and a jump seat where pilots deadhead. And that was pretty routine. Once you learned how to do that, because pilots love to talk shop so much, same jargon, it was routine. I would just step on board. Good evening, gentlemen. Bob Davis, Pan Am. Welcome aboard, Bob. And I'd hang my coat up and sit down on the taxi out, always the same stuff. Hey, Bob, how long you been with Pan Am? Oh, I've been flying about 7 years. What position you fly? Right seat, which was airline terminology for a co-pilot. What type of equipment are you on? Had that one down. Perfect. Matter of fact, whatever they flew, I didn't fly. So I had no problems with that. Now, when we'd arrive in Chicago, I'd get off the Eastern flight, and then I'd walk up to the Pan Am ticket counter, about the closest I like to come to Pan Am people, and the girl would look up and see me and say, yes, sir, can I help you? Excuse me, where do we lay over here? I had the deadhead of trip in here. I've never laid over in Chicago. Oh, certainly, sir. You can catch the crew bus downstairs. We stay at the Parma House Hilton. Thank you. And I'd go down to the Parma House Hilton, and I'd check in, and at the end of the registration desk, it would say, airline crews, register here. So I'd walk in and sign in. They'd give me a key. I'd stay 2 or 3 days, and Pan Am would be billed for my rooms. I also could write a check, because if you're an airline crew member, they usually would cash your check up to $100. But then I found out that every airline honors every other airline employee's personal check up to $100. Now, when I found that out, I don't know, in L.A., I would start and go Eastern, Delta, United. Oh, I wasn't prejudiced. Air Iran, KLM, Air France. It would take me a good 8 hours to get all the way around that horseshoe down there to Continental. Now, when I got down there, 8 hours had gone by. What do you have? Shift change. New people. So all the way back around way this way. Now, I made a great deal of money, and the only reason I stopped at 18 is because the FBI finally did issue a warrant for interstate transportation of worthless checks. The warrant, however, described me as being approximately 28 years old. So I decided that I had a great deal of money. It was a good time to hang the uniform up. I moved to Atlanta, Georgia, into a very swank singles complex that had just been built called the Riverbend Apartments. And on the application for the lease, one of the questions was, occupation. Well, I began to write down airline pilot, but the next question said supervisor's name, phone number. And I thought to myself, pretty classy place. They might call personnel Pan Am in New York and verify all this. I'll have to come up with something that would be almost impossible to check out. So I wrote down the word doctor. Nothing else. But I had a very inquisitive apartment manager, and she said, oh, I see here you're a doctor. Yes, ma'am. What type of doctor are you? Well, I'm a medical doctor. However, I'm not practicing medicine right now. I've left my practice out in Los Angeles to invest in some real estate for about a year, so I won't be practicing. How interesting. Well, tell me, what type of medical doctor are you? I figured being a singles place, pediatrician would be pretty safe, and I moved in. Dr. Frank Williams, pediatrician. Everyone called me Doc, and the people you met there always asked you the routine things. So, Doc, where'd you go to medical school? Columbia University in New York. Where'd you serve your internship? At Harvard Children's Hospital in L.A. And once in a while, one of the guys would come over. What's up, Paul? Hey, Doc, you've got to look at my leg. Look, I don't know what I did to it. Look, Paul, you need to go to your own doctor and let him look at that. I can't help you. Everything was going just great. I was living there about 2 months, nobody bothering me. Frank Williams was the name I was using. And one afternoon, there was a knock on my door, and opened the door, a very distinguished gentleman, about 55, standing there. Dr. Williams, yes, my name is Gordon. Just moved in the apartment below you. Wanted to come up and introduce myself. Oh, a new neighbor. Come on in. Well, I'm not only a new neighbor. I understand you are a pediatrician. Ah, yes, that's correct. I'm the chief resident pediatrician of the hospital up the street. One of those guys you wish would OD in your living room or something. Really? I said, well, we'll have to get together. And out the door he went. And I started to pack. But then I thought, no, I don't want to start running again. I've been living here 2 months, not breaking any laws, not bothering anybody. I'll just ignore this guy. But Dr. Gordon was difficult to ignore because he loved to talk medicine. He loved to talk shop. And so every day, I mean literally on the way to the tennis court, out to the pool, to my car, he would stop me. And not being able to speak medical terminology, I always had to cut him short. I knew that eventually he would become very suspicious. So finally, every day I started to go to Emory University's medical library. And I would stay from about 9 in the morning till 3 in the afternoon. I had an IQ of 140, a photographic memory. And I would read the daily journals that would come in from the Mayo Clinic and the London Clinics. And knowing that no doctor kept up with the daily journals, I would memorize them. And then I would stop Dr. Gordon, literally every day. Hey, Doc, hear about this new theory they're using up at Mayo? And pretty soon, hey, Doc, I don't have time to talk to you right now. I got to go. I started to ignore me. One afternoon, he came and he said, you know, we're opening the new hospital in Marietta. He said, the suburb up here, it's a new county hospital. I'd like you to come on opening day. I've told everyone about you. I knew I couldn't get around it, so I said, certainly, I'd be happy to go. Spent the entire day there. I met everyone, orderlies, nurses, department heads, administrators, went to a luncheon with about 30 doctors. When I left at 4 o'clock, there wasn't a soul there that didn't believe I was Dr. Frank Williams, pediatrician from Los Angeles, who wasn't practicing. I started to date one of the nurses who worked there, and every so often when she'd work a little late, I'd sit in the lobby and wait for her. I was there one evening when here comes the hospital administrator, who was not a physician, but the administrator of the hospital. Dr. Williams, I cannot believe you're here. I was just on my way to my office to call you. Sir, it is urgent that I speak to you right away. Certainly. And I walked in his office. He said, I don't know how to ask you this. I don't even know how to impose on you like this, but Dr. Gordon says you'd be more than happy to help us out. What's the problem? Well, sir, on the midnight to 8 shift, I have a resident who supervises 7 interns and a number of nurses. He's just been notified of a death in his family. He's returning to the West Coast for about 10 days. The problem is I have nobody to cover that shift. Georgia law requires the resident either be a full practitioner or a specialist. I have neither. And without working triple shifts and with the shortage of doctors here in Atlanta, I really don't know what to do. Dr. Gordon suggested you being a specialist, a pediatrician, you could cover the shift. I see. Well, I tell you, I would be happy to do that, but I'm afraid I'll have to say no. Why is that? Well, you see, I'm not licensed to practice medicine in the state of Georgia, only in the state of California where I hold my residency. Oh, that's the least of my problem. I just bring you before the medical review board tomorrow morning. They'll give you some verbal questions, and based on that, they'll issue a temporary Georgia certificate. Oh. Now, being one who hates to pass up a challenge, I couldn't help but give it a shot. And next thing you know, here I am in this hospital, 18 years old, smock on, stethoscope in my pocket, don't know which end you stick where, supervising this staff. Now, people later would say, you know, that had to be, of all the things you did, that had to be the most difficult. But not really. It turned out to be really the easiest.
And
it really surprised me. I remember like the first night I was there, it was about 2 o'clock in the morning, the nurse came up and said, I know you haven't done this for a while, but don't forget you need to write in the charts for the end of the shift. I'll write the charts. Thank you. And I went up to the nurse's station and I opened the charts, couldn't read a word. I mean, you have to see the way this doctor's right. Couldn't make out anything. I thought if I write something, nice penmanship, doesn't make any sense, they'll know I'm a phony. So I would literally scribble for about 3 lines. I mean, I never wrote anything, just sign it. Nurses would come over. Thank you, doctor. No problems. Oh, no, everything's in order. Nobody ever asked me what I wrote. Another thing I didn't like was I can't stand the sight of blood. So I hated any time you heard, Dr. Williams to emergency, please. Dr. Williams to emergency 3, please. Now, I used to hate to be called to the emergency room. I didn't even hang out down there because they're always bringing people cut and stabbed up. And when I go down there. We always have in a hospital what we call an ERT, an emergency room technician, a specialist who deals in life and death situations. Overflow goes to the interns as a question. They call the resident down. I'd walk into emergency three, and I'd let the doors shut right behind me, because if I walked up to the table and the guy was bleeding, I'd throw up all over him. But when I was called down, I became very aggressive. Dr. Barnes, did you call me? Sorry to bother you, Doctor. Severe enclosure of the cardio with a broken... Dr. Barnes, life and death situation? Life and death, Doctor? Of course not. Standard procedure. We were going to administer 30 cc's. Dr. Klein? Standard procedure, Doctor. Gentlemen, I suggest you have at it. And out the door I went. I was the most respected resident because I was the only one ever let the interns do anything. They loved me. The nurses, they didn't like me too much because, well, I was always chasing the candy stripers. But they were my age. The nurses were too old for me. Nobody ever understood that. Now, I was there about 8 days when the hospital administrator came up and told me the man I was relieving had resigned. He was not coming back. And would I mind staying on till they got a replacement? I'd already been there 8 days. Why not? Stayed there 1 year, 12 months, 5 nights a week. No one ever found out I was not a physician. During the time I was there, I never administered drugs, never treated a patient, never examined a patient, simply administrated a shift. After 1 year, it was I myself who resigned and left. I went to Baton Rouge, Louisiana, because I heard the Attorney General's office was looking for lawyers. And I figured if you can be a doctor, you certainly can be a lawyer. I picked Louisiana, really, for two reasons. Louisiana does not require a law degree to take the bar. Anyone can take the bar. If you pass the bar, you're a licensed lawyer. And of course, Louisiana still today is the only state in the Union that practices under the Napoleonic Criminal Code of Procedure. Had I been a Harvard graduate, magna cum laude in law, and decided to go to Louisiana to practice law, I would still have to study the Napoleonic Criminal Code in order to take the bar. I studied it, took the bar the first time, flunked it. Took it the second time, came very close to passing it. Took it the third time, passed it. State licensed me under the name Bob Conrad. I went to work for then Attorney General P.F. Grimion in the Civil Division of the Court. I stayed there about 1 year, and once again, on my own, resigned and left. I went to Brigham Young University. They were looking for a professor of sociology, Ph.D. I competed with three other real professors, and they selected me. They hired me, and I taught school, which really wasn't much difficulty. I read one chapter ahead of my students. They never knew the difference. Now, before I go on, I have to bring into the story now a man named John Shea. John Shea was an inspector with the FBI out of Washington, D.C. When he was first handed my folder, it was already 3 years old. And he, a 25-year veteran agent, took the folder from the assistant director. When he first skimmed through it, this is some petty thief writing a bunch of $100 checks. Forget about him. Oh, well, he may sound petty to you. These $100 checks have added up to a lot of money. And worse than that, 3 years and nothing but John Doe. He's still active, and we don't even know who he is. It's your case. He took it very reluctant, but he was a brilliant man who, over the years he chased me, I came to admire him considerably. He took the folder to the agent who had the case, dropped it on his desk, and said, two questions before I take this case. Yes, Inspector. Number one, it says this man is 28 years old. Who says? Well, sir, we interviewed a number of flight attendants he dated. They all gave his age as late 20s. He, on every occasion, 28. Really? It also says here you have all 10 sets of his fingerprints. Yes, sir, he leaves them everywhere. And we've ran them. State, county, federal, Interpol, municipalities, military. Nothing. Really? So what we have is a 28-year-old, obviously American male, who has never been fingerprinted. I kind of doubt that. Get me a list of runaways, high school runaways, missing for 3 years, start on the East Coast. And they came up with Frank William Abagnale, Jr. They paid my parents a visit in New York, but they assured the FBI they had not physically seen me in 3 years. The FBI, in turn, turned around and decided that to issue a warrant under the name Frank Abagnale. They took a photograph of me that was used for a 10th grade yearbook, blew it up, and started looking for me. It wasn't long after they got a tip that I lived at the Riverbend Apartments in Atlanta, Georgia. They went there. Of course, I had long moved. You're the manager, Miss? FBI, we're looking for this man. Certainly, that's Dr. Williams. She used to live here. No, ma'am. This man poses as a Pan Am pilot. Oh, no, this is definitely Dr. Williams. Lived here for about a year. Oh, I see. He moved in and told you he was a doctor. Oh, well, he not only told me that, my daughter's a nurse up at the hospital, her boss. He worked in this hospital? Yes. Went up to the hospital, the administrator almost threw him out. Are you out of your mind, 18 years old? Dr. Williams, one of the finest residents we ever had on our staff. Got a tip I was in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. But what I did there, where I was, they didn't know. So, as usual procedure, they sent an outstanding federal warrant to the Attorney General's office for my arrest. They call back. Hey, how come you're looking for Bob Conrad?
Who?
This picture you sent, Frank Abagnale. This is Bob Conrad. You know this man? Know him? He's an attorney on our staff.
An attorney? He worked for you?
Yes. A lot of people say you know, but you became a very, very famous thief as well. I probably became a famous thief mainly because of my age and the things that I did had never been done before. I was more of a criminal of opportunity. But, for example, I walked in a bank in Chicago, 19. I was opening a checking account with $100 cash. Now, all I intended to do was show them some phony ID, give them a phony name. 2 weeks later, they'd mail me 200 checks with the name on them, and I'd go cash them. But when the new accounts girl came back and said, here's your temporary checks, here's your receipt for your deposit, we'll be mailing you your printed checks in about 10 days. I was always the inquisitive teenager. Excuse me, miss. Notice here you didn't give me any deposit slips. Oh, we don't do that, sir. They'll come in the back of your checkbook, printed with your name and account number when you get them. Oh, really? Well, what if I wish to make a deposit tomorrow? No problem. So you see that table in the lobby says customer service? Just go over there and help yourself to a blank deposit slip. Now, you have to write your name in, write your account number in, but just use those till you get your own. Thank you. And I walked over, and for some reason, I took a big stack of them off the shelf. Nobody cared. And I went back to my hotel. Couldn't sleep. All night, I kept sitting up in bed, turning the light on, looking over at that stack of deposit slips. The next morning, I went out and bought some magnetic ink. This is the ink they use to encode your account number on your deposit slip. And I encoded my account number the bank had assigned to me onto the bottom of every one of these blanks that I picked up. Then I went back to the bank, put it on the shelf in the lobby, and everyone who came in put their money in my account. Had about $40,000 at the end of the day. Needless to say, I made a withdrawal. I was at the Boston Logan International Airport. It was about 11:45 at night. I had been writing bad checks, and I was trying to get out of town. I was in front of the TWA counter. The guy said, sir, like I told you, you missed the last flight. Oh, really? But could you check the OAG guide and see if you have another flight coming up? No, sir, you don't understand. This is Boston. We're under noise abatement controls here. There are no jet flights after midnight. Next flight is at 6:30 in the morning. And I sat down wondering what to do, and I noticed all the ticket counters closing down, rent-a-cars, gift shops, Dobbs House. They're all sticking their money in these night bags. And then they'd zip them closed, lock them, put them under their arm, and they'd walk over to the bank in the lobby. And they'd stick a key in the night box, drop the bag, make sure it went down, and there was a line of them. And I watched this, and the next night I came out about 11:45 wearing a bank guard's uniform. I was pushing a big dolly with a container and some press-on letters with the name of the bank on the side, and I hung a beautiful sign over the box that said, night box out of order, please leave all deposits with guard on duty. Everyone did. I was the guy sitting there getting scared because it kind of dawned on me as I was doing this. I said, can a box be out of order? I mean, that's like a mailbox out of order something. These people just dropped the bags in. I used to also kite checks. And when you kite checks as a professional, or what a con man calls a scam, there are three elements, what you call the kite, the front, and the sting. Now, it is said that a good con man will spend about $50,000 in a period of a month, all for the image, for the front. Because the better the front, the more successful the sting. I was doing just that. I moved into the penthouse suite of the Fontainebleau Hotel in Miami, which back then was $600 a day. I had a Rolls Royce and a chauffeur. Still 19 years old, I looked about early 30s, and my name was Alan Scott, supposedly a very wealthy stockbroker from California. And for 3 weeks, I played the role very well. As a matter of fact, probably overplayed the role, because the general manager of the Fontainebleau, so impressed with who he thought I was, one afternoon stopped me on the way through the lobby. Mr. Scott, I know you're very busy, sir. Could I have a moment just to introduce you to someone? Certainly. Mr. Scott, His Honor the Mayor of Miami, Mayor King, Mr. King, Alan Scott. And I met the mayor, and we talked for a few minutes, and I started to walk away, and the mayor said, Mr. Scott. Yes, Your Honor. I'm giving a private party at my home tonight, black tie affair. I'd like you to come. 8:00? Thank you. I'll be there. But, like all criminals, sooner or later you get caught. I was caught when I was 21 years old in a small town in southern France called Montpellier. I was living there in a small house, and an Air France stewardess recognized me one afternoon while I was out at a vegetable market, wrote down the license plate number of my car, reported it to the police, and I was arrested a couple of days later. When the French government took me into custody, 26 countries, including the United States, filed warrants for my arrest. But the French government said, not so fast. We caught him. And when we're done with him, who's ever next in line may have him. I was convicted in France on charges of forgery and sent to a French prison. My sentence was held at a place called the Maison d'Arrêt, the house of arrest, in a small town called Pepignan, in the southern portion of France. In France, you're not told how much time you have. You're just sent to prison. When I arrived there, the building was built in the 17th century. It had no heating, no plumbing, and no electricity. I was totally stripped of every piece of clothing I had and taken downstairs to a cell. In Chapter 8, I described the life in the French prison. Jean Shalit years later would review the book and say probably the most powerful chapter he has read in any book. The French prisons, briefly, was a room that was exactly 5 feet by 5 feet by 5 feet. I'm 6 foot tall. I was pushed into this room, a little steel door, totally nude, and the only thing in the room was a bucket. Absolutely no light. When they shut the door, like a planetarium with the lights out, completely black. And you kind of felt at first that they're just here temporarily and then they'll move you to a cell. But they never came back for 6 months. Bread and water for breakfast, bread and soup for lunch, bread and coffee for dinner. And you went to the bathroom in that bucket, and when it overflowed on the floor in a week or so, you assumed they would come in and empty it and clean out the cell. But they never did. 6 months later, literally, you had to sleep up, sitting up to help from drowning in your own urine and waste. Rats, bugs, everything imaginable. I went from 198 pounds to 109 pounds, caught double pneumonia, almost lost my life there. After 6 months, the French government took me out. I was showered and shaved for the first time and cleaned up, haircut, put on the clothes I came in with that had to be tied with a rope, very ill. I was informed that I was being extradited to the country of Sweden to face criminal charges of forgery. I was extradited to Sweden. The Swedish judge took one look at me and ordered me hospitalized. When my health was back, they sentenced me to 6 months in a Swedish prison, which was more to the other extreme. They were very nice, very comfortable. I owe the Swedish people my life because it was they who decided that I had paid twice for the same crime. And rather than turn me over to the Italian government, they ordered me deported back to the United States. I was sent back to the United States, and of course, once you're back on your own soil, a citizen cannot be extradited to another country for a crime from their own country. So those countries had to forget about the charges. I was convicted in federal court in Atlanta, Georgia, on interstate transportation of forged checks. The judge didn't consider or care about the year I spent in the European jails. He gave me 10 years in federal prison. And on top of that, he said because of the notoriety I had of eluding the law, he was sending me to the Atlanta Federal Penitentiary to serve my time. Today, I'm the youngest man ever confined behind the walls of the Atlanta Federal Pen. I literally went there 15 years under the minimum age requirement set by the U.S. Bureau of Prisons. I went there because the government felt it had never had an escape there since 1902, and that's where I should be sent. I was there 13 days when I became the first man ever to escape the Atlanta Federal Penitentiary. I didn't go over the 40-foot walls. I impersonated a federal prison inspector and walked out the front door of the prison. When they caught me again, the judge gave me 2 more years for those charges. I spent a total of 4 years in U.S. federal prison in Virginia and was paroled in February 1974 to Houston, Texas, where today I make my home. As part of my parole, the government offered me my release if I would write policy, procedure, and programs for law enforcement agencies to deal with sophisticated white-collar crime. I would do that on my own at no compensation other than my release on very supervised parole. I agreed, and for 2 years I wrote those procedures while working in a grocery store midnight to 8 stocking groceries. The procedures that the government uses as standard practice in the Department of Justice became so successful in dealing with white-collar crime that the government asked me to consider doing it in the private sector. 7 years ago, I opened up Frank W. Abagnale and Associates with nothing more than $50, a phone mate, and started going around giving presentations to business industry on fraud and fraud prevention. Today, that company grosses in the millions of dollars with offices throughout the United States. And today, my company writes the procedures for the 7 largest commercial banks in the world, some of the largest hotels in the world, and some of the largest companies and retailers in the world. I, of course, back in 1980, wrote a book called Catch Me If You Can, published by Grosset and Dunlap in New York. The book sold 1 million copies in hardback, never leaving Time Magazine's bestseller list for 15 months. Bought by Simon & Schuster's Pocketbooks for paperback version, it went to 3 million copies in less than 2 years, never leaving the top 10 best-selling paperbacks on the market. Today, it is published in 8 different languages and the number 1 best-selling book in Europe 4 years later. The book has been written into a screenplay. It is now being developed for a major motion picture. And I, myself, continue to do basically the same thing. Occasionally, I get asked to do a talk like this about my life, and I enjoy doing so. A couple of years ago, I took $2.5 million out of my company's profits, and I returned every single penny of it to every airline, hotel, bank, and person that ever lost a dime 15 years earlier. Today, not one soul is out any money from any of the crimes that I committed in my youth. In closing, I would simply like to end that I would never like anyone to leave one of these presentations and for a moment admire what I did or for some reason think it's glamorous. Glamour is much like the beauty of a woman, always in the eyes of the beholder. I myself never saw my life as glamorous. I saw it as a very lonely, very despairing life. I came from a very close family. I loved each one of them, my brothers and my sister. We grew up together, and I chose to run away from home, from a broken home that I could not accept. For 5 years, I literally did not see my parents. I did not have a mother to tuck me in at night. I spent my birthdays and my Christmas alone, most of the time running from the police in a different hotel every night. I wasted all of my youth. As a matter of fact, today, I would like very much to know what it's like to be 18 years old, have shared a love with someone my age, to have gone to a football game or a basketball game, to have done the things that come natural to every teenager. Unfortunately, a lot of teenagers today are all trying to do the same thing, grow up too fast. 14-year-olds trying to be 22-year-olds, and even us, 36-year-olds trying to accomplish what took our fathers 60 years to do. All for what? For nothing. I wasted a great deal of my life, a great deal of it. Only in a great country like America did I have the opportunity to repent and come back and do something with my life in the positive side. I've learned one thing from all of this, one thing that is very important, and as we go through life, we learn from others' mistakes, and I'd like to leave you with that. I loved my father very, very much. I was named after him. He died before I ever got to tell him I was sorry for what I had done while I was in prison. I was not allowed to go to his funeral visit. Matter of fact, the only American prisoner ever denied a funeral visit to an immediate family member by the government, again because of my escape notoriety. So I didn't even get to go to his grave. What I've learned in life is that through all of it, money, materialistic things can be had by anyone. Success, if you want it, you can get it. But there are certain things, and one very special thing in life, that a lot of us unfortunately take for granted, and that is family. And I say to you today, as you sit out there, if you had a father who has brought you into this world, who has fought in a war so that you can live in peace, who has raised you and supported you, a mother who has actually given her life to doing nothing but bringing you up into this world, and if you have at home a child to go home to and to kiss and waiting for you, and you can understand the love that a child can have for a parent and that a parent can have for a child, and I say to you that family is the most important thing in life. You come into life with it, and you leave life with it. Never risk it. God bless you, and thank you very much for having me here.